It'll be first and 25.
This is First and 25, the Football Zebras podcast, our 25-minute roundtable discussion on officiating. I'm Ben Ostro, the founder and editor-in-chief of Football Zebras, joined by our editor, Cam Philippe, and writer, Patrick Weber. So let's start with an interesting play we saw over the weekend in Seattle. Seahawks were attempting to tie the game on a field goal, which was blocked by Isaiah Simmons of the Giants and returned by Bryce Ford Wheaton for a touchdown. Simmons was through the line pretty quickly to execute the block, and so we took a look at all of the elements. First of all, how Simmons got through so quickly, and then there was whether or not there was holding on the line by Raheem Nunez-Roches, who was pushing on the center. So we did have a little bit of a breakdown but in the live blog, but there seems to be a lot of questions. So let's step this through this mechanically, at least from an officiating standpoint. I'll start with you, Patrick, on this one.
Yeah, so we see when the officials go into field goal mechanics, you have the field judge and the back judge on the uprights. Then you have the side judge and the umpire kind of in the defensive backfield. And the umpire generally has the snapper and the ball, and the side judge is helping out as well to see who's eligible to try and leap or who can't leap and make sure there's not holding on the line for a pull and shoot. We saw that a couple weeks ago in Tennessee Green Bay where one of the linemen pulled an offensive lineman clearly to the side so that a linebacker could shoot that gap. Pretty savvy play by the Giants to kind of make it legal and execute a play.
Now, in a play like this, you didn't have the pull and shoot, which is why we didn't see a flag there. It was more of a push than a pull, which is why it doesn't rise to the level of a holding foul, a defensive line holding foul. But then again, now that there's a push involved, you have to go in and see, could this potentially be a leverage foul, which we did see earlier in the day called in a different game. But even though we have a push here, in order for it to be leverage, you have to perform that push in order to gain height. And this really wasn't to gain height. It was to clear the gap. So it was a great play without holding, being able to push the offensive lineman out of the gap to force the blocker through makes it a legal play. And, you know, it's a heads up call, I guess, or no call, because it's a lot happening at once. Because I didn't see the play when it happened live. I saw it about an hour later, and it all happens very quickly. And you have to be able to slow the game down in your mind and process it to make sure that it's legal contact, because here it was in this case.
Yeah, that's a great point too, because we're also dealing with the long snapper in this case, who has extra protections, you know, is protected from forcible contact to the head or neck, but a push down really isn't forcible contact. And I also don't believe they got him in the head or neck area to begin with.
It speaks to the acuity of both of the officials that are back there in that double umpire mechanic. Boris Cheek, one of the most tenured officials in the league, who has seen many a postseason assignment, and the umpire there, Alex Moore, who I would say is one of the best up-and-coming officials. You know, you got both ends of the spectrum there, and, you know, they were able to rule on this one properly.
Pulling out all of the elements that people are questioning on this play, and so you're shuttling this back multiple times, and then we just realize that the sequence of events here was not a fluke. This was coached. This was someone that at the special teams level, a special teams coach that comes in and runs this by their, whoever their internal expert is, the one that they used to have is now at the league office. So I don't know who they have now, but essentially running through these elements. And on top of that, they do have the channels to the league office to request, if we do this, what is, you know, is there a foul? Is this something else? And they can kind of help them with the contours if there's any question on that. But in this particular situation, you first start with the fact that the coaches definitely drew this up specifically. The players executed what was written to them, and whether or not the officials were tipped off in the pregame meeting, which would probably be a good idea to say, hey, we have this play where we're going to push at the center. We're not pulling, and it's going to look like the guy got through pretty quickly, and your instinct might be to pull the flag, but we're strictly on a push on this, so keep an eye on this. And all three of those elements added to the fact that, yes, you do have two of the best officials in that position. It all the ingredients come together and play that completely changed the game. We're not dealing with overtime, but we're dealing with a return the other way and a win for the Giants.
Yeah, I also think there can be the feeling in the officiating community that the coaches don't always know the rules very well. So I think there's definitely, I always think it's cool to see in a tip of the cap when coaches do a deep dive and have a well-found exploit.
And that's the other thing. So we mentioned the fact that on top of that, they're trying to create this gap on a protected player. So now there's already an extra set of rules in play. And just basically, I believe it was 2015 that they added the long snapper to the list of defenseless players. And the contact that is prohibited is only to the head or neck area, forcible contact or any kind of spearing, but the posture that they're in, there's just no way to execute a spearing maneuver. But in essence, the snapper's got his head down and is trying to right himself up and is not looking at contact that is coming towards him, so does not have that ability to ward off that contact. So we see the two hands from Nunez Roches on the back of the center and very clearly out and probably being extra demonstrative as to where his hands are, not like trying to hide what he's doing, making sure everything is out in the open so that it doesn't get flagged. But there's just so many elements. And, well, the one thing we didn't mention was Simmons and his effort getting through the line and what he needs.
So there's a lot that has to happen here, especially with the rules that have changed in the last, we were just talking before we started recording how rules that may seem like they were changed only 3 or 4 years ago is actually more like 7 to 10. So, but in this scenario, in terms of if you want to leap over a player that's on the line of scrimmage, first of all, you have to be lined up on the line of scrimmage and you can't make contact as you're going over. And additionally, with leverage, as we previously explained, you can't use opponents to gain height. So here, looking at the play, pushing the long snapper out of the way, he really doesn't have to jump that much. So it really clears that red flag that you may get tipped off to when you're watching a play like this, because he's able to shoot that gap more easily without, as we've seen in the past, just people that are just completely, and obviously this isn't legal anymore, but they just completely long jump or high jump, I should say, scale the offensive lineman to try to get in front of the kicker. So a lot needs to be done there, but that push block or shedding the block, I should say, really helped in making that a legal tactic.
Yeah, like we said, I mean, they checked all the boxes because the player that leapt over lined up within a yard, a push, not a pull. I mean, it's a very well-designed and executed play. One thing I think is interesting when it comes to long snapper, like in college, there's more of a timing element to when the snapper can be blocked. In the NFL, there is not. And they're kind of taking advantage of the snapper's head being down, even though it is allowable contact. It kind of makes you wonder if this becomes a prevalent tactic, if this is something the league looks at.
It's the same thing at the high school level. We're generally, our mechanic at the high school level is, when we have a scrimmage kick, the umpire and the referee will usually say something to the effect of, stay off the center, stay off the center. And the center cannot be contacted, period, until they regain that passing posture. So again, it was something that I was thinking of, Pat, before you mentioned that, if it's something that may be something that trickles up to give the center or long snapper more protection when they haven't regained that passing posture, and not just have the typical defenseless protections, as in like for head neck area and contact with the head.
Well, one of the things that, like you said, there's a specific time element in college that's dictated in the rule book as to where when the contact can initiate. I think what the NFL did is try to figure out, okay, we don't want to prescribe a time element, because then it just adds another piece of overhead to the play. And I think that by making sure that nobody lines up over the center, in addition to having the defenseless posture rule in effect for the long snapper, that it essentially creates an artificial delay that you would not have ordinarily contacted the center. So maybe it's not the full second, but at the pro level, it's like, all right, we've got to give a little bit of time, and then there's a little bit of hesitancy to contact the long snapper just in case you happen to make contact with the head or neck area and draw the flag, or at least come close enough that maybe he jars and it's picked up that way as well, that there was contact when there wasn't. So there may be that hesitancy, and then that is what kind of buys the time in element in the NFL. A lot of moving parts on such a small part of the play. Obviously, most of the play is the run back for the touchdown, but there are just so many elements that were compacted within that one part of it just before the kick. And we did see there was one other player on the Giants who kind of did, like, I would kind of classify it as almost trying to swim over the top. But again, it still comes back to there's blocking going on. Yeah, you're going to jump to try and block it, but is it an effort to gain that additional height? There really wasn't that push down to gain height. It was more of the block kind of continued and tried to force himself over the top to try and get into blocking it. But again, on top of that, that element was on the opposite side of the line and not anything that opened up the lane for Simmons. That was strictly on the contact with the long snapper.
And a fun little footnote on this play: when the try was attempted afterward, New York elected to take a knee, which was pretty interesting. And again, it goes back to great coaching. If there had been a botched extra point or anything like that that had returned for a defensive two-point conversion, it would have been a one-score game. So just a little interesting footnote there.
Yeah, I mean, you could have had players on Seattle saying, hey, we just learned something new. We're going to try it out on the ensuing extra point. And that's a good point. And one of the other things, I'm kind of throwing this out because it just occurred to me, but we did see this in the Sunday night game, where there were some tactics to try and block by timing the snap from the outside. And we saw this, there was a game in Carolina, I believe it was against the Texans last year, and the Texans were continually penetrating the line, creating an unabated situation, which means we shut down the snap. There, you know, even though the kicker kicks through and it goes through, we cannot count that play because it's been blown dead. But it gets into this territory where it's unsportsmanlike conduct, which doesn't really penalize you when you start to get into this half-distance territory. It's just the same as if you had a 5-yard penalty or 15-yard, it's still half the distance. But then we get into this area, this deep recess of the rule book that's been probably quizzed on every official and up, down, and sideways, but we've never seen it used in the NFL, which is the palpably unfair act, which basically says, hey, if something's just going completely off the wall and it is definitely unsportsmanlike and 15 yards is not cutting it, they have the ability in this particular case to say, well, the most equitable thing to do is we've warned you continue to do this, and we're just going to award the point without them having to kick the ball. it's never gotten to that level. We've enlisted the help of quirky research to try and find one. There's a bunch of them in college, but not any in the NFL. But that was another tactic that popped up in field goal blocking. I just want to shift gears a little bit. We're going to kind of look at some of these celebration penalties that have come up lately. A lot of them circling around weapons and finger guns, and where's that line between the two? And within the same weekend, we saw another instance of somebody kind of, you know, doing a what seems to be harmless finger gun gesture, and then somebody else that just had this. It the only way to describe it, it was in a college game. It was like a mock execution. It was like firing at point blank range. And, you know, maybe it's a little fun on one end, and on the other end, it's like, oh my God, that's just horrible. And, you know, we saw in 2017 that the NFL said, look, we're going to open up the celebration rules. We're going to dial everything back that we've done previously. But there's just some lines that we don't want you to cross. Now this year, we're just seeing a lot of these penalties come up seemingly out of nowhere.
It seems to me, because of how many that we've seen recently, the mind that I have makes me think it feels like they're just doing it on purpose to test the waters. I don't know if there's any truth to that or not, but just the fact that there's another one, and there's another one. And after I saw that one I forgot what teams were playing in that college game, but that was, there's just no words to describe that. And if you're listening, you probably have already seen it. So there's really no need to describe it any more than it already has been. But, you know, when they expanded the celebration rules, when they kind of loosened the lid a little bit to allow a little bit more, they still prohibited anything that was violent or suggestive or, you know, anything directed at an opponent, because that's taunting and that's always been taunting. But I have the rule reference here, and under unsportsmanlike conduct, this is rule 12.3.1.D. Such acts specifically include, among others, any violent gesture or an act that is sexually suggestive or offensive. Just stay with the former there. Shooting a gun, whether it's an innocent finger gun, I would argue is a violent gesture, I would say. And again, it's up to interpretation, but clearly there's a directive that's been going around, I would guess, not only in the NFL, but likely at the college level as well, because we've been seeing them a lot in the first month and a half, almost, not even, of the season.
Yeah, it was interesting with that first flag that kind of set the waves in motion in the Atlanta game with the touchdown late, with the very clearly firing gun in the crowd. On the NCAA training tape the next week, they reinforced that any simulation of weapons is not allowed. So it very much became an emphasis at the college level. And I think every time we see these fouls start to crop up, you know, we get the old no fun league added again. You know, in some cases, maybe we get that feeling too, but they expanded and allowed all the celebrations. They just said, here's a couple things we don't want you to do. Like, it shouldn't be that hard to take that other 98% and have the fun and just leave those two or three things alone. You know, I know it's not the violent gestures, but there was another foul for dunking on the crossbar, I think, over the weekend. It might have been the Thursday night game. I mean, if I could dunk over the crossbars, I would too, because why not show that off? But it's such an easy foul to avoid when you can do pretty much anything else in your celebration.
Well, and that was one that was specifically called out as, not using prop. And they specifically, beyond what's in the rule book, because these penalties are expandable within the player's manual. And I think there was a reason for doing that. It used to be pretty detailed in the rule. But I think they kind of offloaded that and said, well, let's put some general descriptions here. I think the thinking was, let's not have something new come along, which we want to implement, but we can't, because we can't implement a rule change like this. But we can send out a memo and say, okay, we're putting this under this envelope, and be aware. We see these things where it's like, it's where the edges is testing the edges. And it's like, okay, well, is this acceptable? And bow and arrow. Now I'm hearing that enforcement on the bow and arrow, as long as it's not pointed at an opponent, that's legal. And the other thing is, the last thing is, the officials don't even want to be policing this stuff. They have a job to do. They have a, you know,
just have a score or turnover or whatever.
They have to set everything in motion, either for the extra point or changeover on the change of possession. So, you know, they're going to pay attention for a period of time, and then it's time to move on. And in the case of relaxing the celebration rules, the NFL kind of said, our enforcement of the celebration not getting too excessive is, we're running the play clock. So we're not going to make it a 15, but we're going to make it a 5 if you take too much time. As far as I know, I mean, there was a few the first season. Once they opened up the door and everybody was able to do things, yeah, there were a few delay a game or timeouts that were taken to avoid the delay. But this testing of the edges, it's probably really frustrating the officials, because they're having to go over tape of all these things that are just really not football. And it's like, you had one thing a couple of years ago. They're like, well, how many pumps of your hips count as a sexually suggestive gesture? It's like, well, don't test the waters. Just don't do that. You have all these other things that you could possibly do. Let's go off to another, in the 2 minutes that we have left, we saw not a celebration after a touchdown, but we just saw an absolute brawl open up in the Bears-Panthers game. A couple of ejections. There were still some more flags. There was another unsportsmanlike conduct, or an unnecessary roughness, rather, that was assessed. And again, it's not a balanced thing. It doesn't matter if you have three on one side, one on the other. It all, as long as there's one, at least one by either team, they all offset. The ejections don't offset. Those will stand. Let's just kind of step through. You just had a score, and now everybody's mixing it up. Obviously, your alarms go up, and you're armed with a whistle and a flag, and that's it. So what goes on when this erupts on the field?
I'm sure that each crew has their own way of handling this, because generally what you'll see is, you'll see three or four, depending how big the scrum is, you'll see three or four going in trying to separate, and then you'll see a few that are just standing back. And a lot of times, you know, you'll see people say, oh, they don't want to get involved in the contact, they're not up for it. But no, that purpose actually is very significant. They're standing back to get numbers. They're looking to see, you know, if there are punches thrown or things like that. They're trying to mark off, you know, it was exactly, you know, it was 71 that threw a punch. I was able to see that because I was standing back. I wasn't right in the middle. So additionally, being able to have the assistance to get those numbers for non-football acts from upstairs and from New York, that helps as well. But to be able to contain it, you need to have those two or three officials back just watching everything play out.
Yeah, it's always important to have at least a couple with the wide view. I know at the professional level, they'll be a little more hands-on. Lower levels, like in college, we will do our best to prevent. But once if it evolves into a fight, we're going to back out and let game day personnel handle that while we just take numbers. But fortunately, I have not really been part of a brawl, so we haven't gotten to that part yet. Usually, we're pretty good at least stopping it in the early stages. But then it is always nice to have replay to get all the numbers for you.
So the NFL is a little more sophisticated, but is there anything at the scholastic level? I mean, do they review a tape afterwards and start imposing sanctions on specific players or to schools? Or is that a little bit more advanced?
I believe college would look at tape. High school, I am not sure.
In Massachusetts, at the high school level, if there is a disqualification involved, there's paperwork that's filled out by the crew that goes to the state's governing body, and film would be reviewed in that aspect to determine whether or not there's a potential suspension moving forward.
And so, like I said, the officials don't like to determine whether or not there's a legal celebration. I think the other thing that they hate is the paperwork too. So a little bit of both there. And with that, it wraps up another episode of the First and 25 podcast. Thanks to Cam Philippe and Pat Weber. We'll be dropping a new episode every Tuesday throughout the season, and please spread the word. If you're listening on the Football Zebras website, you can find us on your preferred podcasting app, and please subscribe. Many thanks for listening.